Hi there. Thanks for joining us as we share stories of what's involved behind the elections. During this episode, we will talk about open primaries, what happened with Ron Paul, and what we can do to have better options when we go to vote. Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Welcome to Homefront. Today we have an amazing show with two amazing guests. They're going to be speaking with us about free and fair elections. Free and fair elections are the hallmark of a free society. Here in America, we go to our local polling place every year to vote in elections. We're given a list of who's up for what. But how do those names get on the ballot? Here are some of the problems we're going to be considering today. Sometimes people are upset that they don't have anyone on the ballot worthy of their vote. We assume there are no good candidates, but that's not always true. What if there were plenty of good candidates out there willing to run, but the structure is making it impossible to get them on the ballot? So if you're not happy with the choices available or how we can make a difference, I've got good news for you. Today, we get to hear from Jim Clymer and Gary Odom. Jim is one of the founders of the Constitution Party. He served three terms as its national chairman. He also is an attorney and practices law in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And for those of you who do not know where Lancaster, Pennsylvania is, it's known as the land of slow horses, older women, and fresh whiskey. So welcome, Jim.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
And we also get to hear from Gary Odom today. Gary has been the national field director for the Constitution Party for 6 years and is an expert on all sorts of ballot access questions, as well as having a vast understanding of how all these laws work. Welcome, Gary.
Cynthia, it's a great pleasure to be with you today.
Likewise. So here's a question I want to throw out there and let you sort it out. A lot of us don't even think about how names appear on the ballot. What has to happen from the day a candidate says, I'm willing to run, to getting his name on the ballot?
Well, I'll start. It really depends on what state you're in. I think I'll start with that. The laws are not uniform among the 50 states. In fact, they're anything but. If there's any similarity between any two states, it's completely coincidental. But generally, for example, in California, where I lived most of my life, except for six wonderful years in Pennsylvania, you have to go down during a certain period of time when filing is open and take out your papers, they call it. But you have to get a certain amount of signatures, and you have a certain amount of time to do it to qualify for the primary ballot, for example. But if your party is not on the ballot, that option is not available to you in most states. I've worked with people who got involved in recent years who came in with great hopes and expectations and had no idea that it took anything more than just going down to file and they'd automatically be on the ballot. It's anything but. You have to meet certain requirements. Some are quite egregious. In some states, they're not so egregious. In some places, it's pretty simple. But they all have rules to follow, and so there's nothing automatic about it. But that's the first step, is to go down, and I don't know, Jim may have something to add to that as far as Pennsylvania.
Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, and I'm supposing that you're talking about independent or third-party candidates who want to get on the ballot. Of course, the Republicans and Democrats have their primary process. Well, that varies from state to state, too, as Gary said. But in most states, they have a primary process where you have to get on the ballot through their party rules, which usually involves getting signatures. But generally speaking, first of all, I agree with everything that Gary said. But generally speaking, to get on the ballot, especially as a minor party or independent party candidate, you must get a certain number of signatures to qualify, and that varies widely from state to state. Some states relatively easy. Some states are so burdensome, so difficult that it's almost impossible to get on.
And then many of us have had experiences where we have seen people standing outside a post office or Walmart trying to get signatures. And what amazes me about that is a lot of people will sign a petition and they don't even know what they're signing. So all this effort to get people to sign a petition, to me, doesn't still capture the essence of what they're trying to accomplish. Because what does that mean if you're just signing your name to be nice or to be amenable or to make the petitioner happy?
Well, Cindy, I think, if I may, in some states where the requirements are fairly modest, it's simply to show that you have some organization and some support. There's an argument for that. But in many states, Pennsylvania being one, California being another, and those, they have two very different systems, but you really have to believe that the reason the requirements are such as they are, in Pennsylvania it's usually around 25 or so thousand signatures, in California it's been 100,000 registrations. It's to keep the incumbents and the powers that be in power, because it's a completely unreasonable requirement. And I would point out that in today's society, petitioning, even though it's considered one of our wonderful freowns, is frowned upon. If you go to Walmart or you go to the post office, and unless you're well off the post office's property, you're going to be thrown off. A lot of people, or they'll put up signs in other places. Here in California, the courts have ruled that you can do it, but they'll put up signs discouraging people from petitioning where people congregate. So you face a lot of obstacles. And you're right, it is somewhat mindless, but basically it's done to discourage people from exercising their rights in most cases.
In Pennsylvania, our Pennsylvania State Constitution includes among its Declaration of Rights that the elections shall be free and equal. I think there are similar provisions in many other constitutions across the country. Well, in fact, they're anything but equal when it comes to access to the ballot box. And, you know, a lot of times you think of that, of course, in terms of being able to vote. But the other side of that equation is being able to get on the ballot so that people have the opportunity to vote for you. And that's where there is anything but equality. And as Gary said, there's the system is designed in many, I'll say most states, to protect those who are in power and to keep anybody else from challenging their base. And the severity of the laws, or the inequality of the laws, is more pronounced in some states than others. But in Pennsylvania, we have a unique system where first of all, let me preface it by saying it's not only the matter of getting the signatures to get on the ballot, which is a tremendous hurdle in itself, but then the risk of once you meet that initial qualification, if you get challenged by somebody else, by a major party or another or anybody else, and you end up getting disqualified because some of the signatures aren't valid or something, you end up paying the legal fees and costs of the party who challenged you to throw you off the ballot. And that's actually happened several times in Pennsylvania, and they've had people having to pay costs, the legal fees and costs of upwards of $100,000 after they got thrown off the ballot. It certainly has a chilling effect of even trying to get on the ballot. And this year in Pennsylvania, although there are three minor parties that attempted to get on the ballot, none of them actually made it. So we have nobody running statewide except the Democrats and Republicans. And it's largely because of that chilling effect.
A lot of people believe the biggest problem is they can't decouple the money from the votes. Part of the problem with the election process is how much money is polluting it. We've had experiences in Missouri where if people can get enough money, they can bring in paid petitioners who can get anything on the ballot they want. And then you have innocent people who sit back who may not have the money. They might have better ideas that should go on the ballot, but they don't have the funding to pay the petitioners. There was an article that I read recently that talked about how Mitt Romney's cost per vote was $18.50. Think about this. Mitt Romney spent $18.50 per vote to become the presidential nominee. At the same time, Santorum spent what came out to $9 a vote. No wonder he lost. If you have this kind of monkey business going on, then the people only see on the ballot who were the biggest donors. They end up seeing who had the deepest pockets. They're not seeing necessarily the people who have the best ideas. So how do we get over having that money so deeply tied to ballot access?
I don't know if there's any easy solution. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, the reality of life is that money makes a difference in whatever area of your life you are. And I have a little bit of a problem with government trying too hard to equalize everything financially. It just can't be done. I mean, the lesson I would say is that people have to learn to be more discriminating, and people have to learn to get involved in searching out the qualities of a candidate rather than just looking at who can run the slickest TV ads or who can saturate their mailboxes and airwaves with the most electioneering, most propaganda. There's no doubt that money does play a part, and it always will, I believe, and it doesn't. But money doesn't always win out. I mean, look at Eric Cantor in his primary race in Virginia, and even though he had outspent them, I forget what it was, but I think it was like 15-1 or something, or perhaps even more than that. He'd outspent his opponent by tremendous sums, but he still lost. So I think we need to be creative and find ways of getting our message out without, if we don't have the money, to find ways of getting the message out without spending as much as the other guys do. The solution, I would say.
Jim, in 2012, Pennsylvania provided the nation with a live experiment on how a political party with deep pockets can sue a political party with shallow pockets. Tell us your story of what happened in Pennsylvania that blocked ballot access from the best candidate of all.
Yeah, well, we had gotten enough signatures. We've gotten like 150% of the threshold amount of signatures that were needed, and thought we should be in good shape. But then the Republicans challenged us, and I say we, I'm talking about the Constitution Party, and they challenged us in court, and as I mentioned before, the we have this crazy law in Pennsylvania that if you lose a ballot access challenge, you end up paying the expenses, the legal expenses of the one who challenged you. So there we had 20 people on the ballot as electors, in addition to the statewide candidates, and we all got sued on this, and Gary was one of those involved as well. And, you know, we got a stack of papers served on us that were literally 6 or 8 inches high. I mean, it was that thick. And if you can imagine the expense of just preparing and serving that amount of paperwork on, I forget the total number, it was like 20, 25, 26 people across the state. I mean, the expense of doing that by itself was tremendous, besides all the work that went into preparing that paperwork. And then we got into court, and of course they're raising all kinds of challenges. There were bad precedents that we had to deal with, because back when the Democrats wanted to keep Ralph Nader off the ballot in 2004, the court had issued some horrible rulings where they were invalidating signatures for just very minor reasons, that their name wasn't spelled right, they used a nickname instead of their formal name the way it's on the registration, and ridiculous things like that. So we're faced with some bad precedent, which caused us to question whether we would end up having enough, and then faced with what surely would have exceeded $100,000 in expenses if we lost. It was a risk that none of us were willing to take.
And it was a risk, if I may interject, it was a risk that it wasn't just some silent risk. The Republicans were saying, if you don't give up now, we're going to go after costs. So what they were, their ultimate objective was to throw us off the ballot, whether we surrender or whether, you know, we were massacred to the person. It was a threat.
We were pretty much given an ultimatum that said either you withdraw now, and this is when I say now, this was in the early stages of the court battle where we were going over the signatures, either you withdraw now or we're going to go after you for all of our costs. And so it was a very real threat. It wasn't a bluff, it was a very real threat.
And where is the justice in that? I mean, it used to be that a person's honor would prevent them from filing a lawsuit for no apparent good reason. You know, that the reason I'm sure Pennsylvania wanted to have a law that made you pay for their legal expenses was because originally they imagined if somebody's wrong enough to have incurred a lawsuit, then they must be really bad, bad people. They didn't understand maybe that there are those who would manipulate those laws. And about the bad precedents, what kind of a country do we live in today where you can have a coin flip who's going to win? It should be that the law is more clear than that. And how did your state, Pennsylvania, get such convoluted laws that you could lose even if you're the good guys?
Yeah, well, let me say, though, that there is some good news. We filed a lawsuit, we, the Constitution Party, along with the Green Party and the Libertarian Party, actually, filed a lawsuit to challenge that system. And of course the establishmentarian judge at the district court level threw it out, said that we didn't have standing, and did that in the face of contrary law, but you know, he wanted to get rid of us. We filed an appeal with the Third Circuit, and just a couple months ago the Third Circuit actually reversed and sent it back. So we're still in court. It's a long, drawn-out process, but with what we got from the Circuit Court of Appeals, it's a pretty good. Doesn't mean we've won yet, but it means at least we have a chance to be heard, and the court's going to be forced to deal with the issues that we're raising on the merits instead of just throwing it out and saying that we don't have standing to bring such a lawsuit. So that's a glimmer of hope. And I think sometimes just the fact that we have a little success in the courts will change the ways of the legislature, and that's what we really hope happens, that we get a ballot access law that greatly improves ballot access in Pennsylvania, enacted as a result of some of the litigation that's going on.
When I was in the legislature in Missouri, there would be representatives who would want to file bills that would deal with certain corporations, such as Planned Parenthood, or they would want to deal even with certain counties. But we were taught early on, you cannot put into state law the name of a company. You can't even put in a, you know, deal with special laws for special counties. You're not supposed to. So consequently, whenever we pass something for St. Louis County, will describe it as a county of this population size with a charter form of government, and then everybody knows what that means. If we're not allowed to put special legislation in for specially named corporations, why would any legislature want to put in law special provisions for any party or recognize any party? What is accomplished by government not being blind to political parties altogether and just letting people put their names on the ballot?
Because they want to maintain their power and their jobs and their control of the system. I mean, that may seem very cynical, but that's exactly what it is, because there's no other good reason for it.
I know in Missouri we have a primary election every year, and our state spends millions of dollars. What would happen if states didn't have primary elections?
And I don't think they should. I think that you raise a very good point. Why should taxpayers like me, who do not belong to either the Democrats or the Republican Party, why should I have to pay for an election, a primary election held by them? Let them, if they want a primary, let them pay their own costs for the primary. Or if they want to nominate their candidates by some other method, let them do it by some other method. But don't make me pay for it. I think it's wrong. I think it's fundamentally and morally wrong to tax the population at large for the parties to hold their primaries.
Well, I probably have a little different view coming from California, where we had in my view, primaries gave the party members an opportunity to control their own party as opposed to just a few. I understand Jim's sentiments on that, but there is another point of view. But as far as the taxpayers being stuck with it, especially in this day and age with the way things are, I certainly understand that. I'd like to mention, if I could, Cynthia, one more thing about going back to the money. There's another aspect of the money. Not only do the powers that be have lots of it to spend, but it's by having ballot laws that exist in many of the states, such as Pennsylvania and California, New York and Georgia, and I could name another's, it's just impossible for any kind of a nascent or new political group to go out and get the signatures by volunteer methods. We've done that in Wyoming and Alaska and some other states, and it's great. But in some of those states where you have to go and get 50,000 signatures as a requirement, and then increase it by half to make sure you have enough good ones, you have to hire people. And when I say you, it means anybody, the Libertarian Party, the Constitution Party. And what's happened ever since I've been involved in this, which is since 1971, so 72 would have been the first election, is that the campaign will spend virtually all of its resources on getting on the ballot and have nothing left to get the message out with. And so that's, believe me, that's part of the plan too. Ron Paul, some people may not remember that Ron Paul ran in 1988 as a Libertarian candidate, and that's one of the things that he talked about and one of the reasons that he never ran again as a Libertarian and ran as a Republican, because of the amount of money you have to spend, the percentage of money you have to spend just to get on the ballot. And then you have nothing left. The well is dry by the time you want to go out and compete with the other parties. And that's another reason for simplifying the ballot laws and making them much more reasonable in most of the states than they are today, so that the new parties are able to compete and not have that great disadvantage. In Pennsylvania, for example, if you run for governor in the Republican Party or Democrat Party, you only have to get 2,000 signatures to be on their primary ballot. Well, if you run for governor in the Constitution Party, you know, you're going to have to get 30 or 40,000 signatures and hold your breath. And so it's just a very unequal situation.
And it can be made worse at any time they want because they're so big. I remember as a child being afraid of spiders, and my mother told me, don't be afraid of the spider because you're bigger than the spider is. You can squash it anytime you want. And I'm saying the Republicans and Democrats can have the power to squash any little party anytime they want. And anytime they're in session, our freedom is at stake. So I've heard a lot of stories that have sounded like their goal is to prevent us from having access and thereby get to control the whole debate. And I appreciate, Gary, you bringing out that there might be glimmers of hope, because we have to have some hope. There has to be a moment when the citizens rise up and say that's wrong. The sad part is most citizens don't know enough to know what's right and wrong, and they don't tune in to how people get on the ballot. If they don't know, how can they fight against it? Most of the laws that are passed in the legislature, people don't find out until after it's done. Missouri has a law that says we, the taxpayers, will pay for a presidential primary every 4 years in February. It's in our Missouri state statutes. It will be in February. Well, in 2012, the National Republican Party said they wanted all the presidential primaries to be held in March instead of February. Well, the state of Missouri could do nothing about it because it's in state law. We can't just change it on a whim depending on what a political party says. So the state of Missouri had no choice but to hold that presidential primary in February. Republican Party National said, if you hold it too early, we're going to punish you by giving your state only half of the delegates at the convention. So as an appeasement measure, the Republican Party said, well, we'll go ahead and let the state spend the millions of dollars to conduct the primary, and then we'll just throw the results in the trash, and we'll have our own caucuses in March. So after spending millions of dollars to hold a presidential primary, they threw the results in the trash. And it was just an exercise of interest. Plus, you had fewer people coming out to vote because they knew that the result would be meaningless. And on top of all that, the Democrats had no reason to vote because they already knew Barack Obama was going to be their nominee. So it was completely pointless and one of the most foolish wastes of government taxpayer money I have ever seen. So at the time, backing up quite a bit, I was the chairman before this of the Republican Central Committee in my county, St. Charles County. And it was obvious from 4 years ago that there were some people who were worried about Ron Paul. Worried, I tell you. How could such a nice gentleman upset and cause all this consternation across the entire country? Well, I'll tell you why they were worried. Because even though Ron Paul ran as a Republican, there were people who were afraid and whispering, he's really a libertarian, you know, because back in 1988, he ran as a libertarian, and that means he's marked for life. So enjoy the humor with me, guys, because this one was unbelievable. I actually went to Washington, D.C., and walked in Ron Paul's office and asked him point blank. He came out and visited with me. And I said, Ron, we sat on the sofa. I said, why? Why do you continue to run in the Republican Party when they're treating you this way? And he said, because this is the only place where you actually can get your word out, your message out. You have a platform. You get invited to the debates. You get invited to share the microphone, finally, with other people. It's the way to get the message out. Nevertheless, his efforts proved very fruitless. At the end of the day, when the Republicans already knew they wanted Mitt Romney and went with him. But nevertheless, back when Missouri was going to do the caucus, as the head of the Republican committee, it would be my job to run the caucus. There were some people who just were so afraid that freedom would reign, that we would have a breakout of the way it's supposed to work. And they really wanted to maintain total control. And I resigned my seat as the chairman before the caucus began. One of my members, committee members, said to me, I wish you wouldn't do that, because if you leave, you never know what's going to happen at the caucus. It's going to be horrible. And you know what? It turned out making nationwide news. People got arrested. It did turn out horrible. So I was wrong that time. Nevertheless, why can't we go back to a caucus system? The people who are afraid of that are saying what they're concerned with is that the power bosses, the power brokers, and the party godfathers will get them to pick who's on the ballot, and it won't be fair and open either. What do you say to that?
I think there's something to it. I grew up in a primary system, and I tend to like that. And I don't know enough about the caucus system that you have there and in Minnesota and other places to really have an opinion. Maybe Jim does, but I think there's something to the argument. It's probably a scare tactic, but I appreciate anything that gives the people a voice, to the extent that anything does anymore.
Well, and I don't have any problem with primaries. We have a primary system in Pennsylvania. I seem to have greater fear of having too much power within the parties. And what happens in Pennsylvania, even though we have a primary system, the parties get together, which is somewhat equivalent to a caucus, and they decide whom they're going to endorse. And then they put tremendous pressure on everybody to withdraw, so that what they like is you go to a primary, but there only be one person on the ballot for each position, which is to me ridiculous. If they're going to do that, why don't they just hold the caucuses and nominate that way instead of supporting the primary system at great expense to the taxpayers, and then but putting tremendous pressure on everybody to withdraw who doesn't receive their endorsement. So, but whichever way, whatever method they use, whether it be by caucus or by convention or by primary, let the parties pay for it themselves. I'm with George Washington, really, in saying that we should beware of the bane of parties, and the partisanship that goes with parties is only harmful to the country and to the political process. That if they're going to be parties at all, let them have minor influence and let's focus on the people who are running and give everybody an equal access to the ballot box.
Well, I'm just going to go back. You mentioned Ron Paul and what he said about why he, you know, ran in the Republican Party. And from his point of view, I can understand that from his experience. And of course, I mentioned that part of that was money. And I know, speaking for myself and possibly for Jim and many in the Constitution Party, we revere Ron Paul, and also probably many of us, I know I do, Pat Buchanan, who ran a couple of times in the Republican primary, and once as an independent, too. But it should be, regardless of whether the establishment people in the GOP were afraid of him, they didn't want him to leave. They wanted him to stay, and that would be true from Buchanan as well, or anybody like him. They want them to stay there and be butting their heads, down at the end of the cul-de-sac in the primaries and in that kind of thing, where they don't take people out of the party. They certainly didn't want Ron Paul or Pat Buchanan to leave the Republican Party and, for example, to join the Constitution Party and lead those people out of the party to build a framework where they could compete in the general election. Because if all they're doing is competing in the primary election, they can live with that. But if all of a sudden they are faced with, you know, a strong independent movement that they have to confront in the general election, you know, they don't like risks, and that will be a risk for sure. I would just point that out, that's why we're better off having people help and build the Constitution Party rather than stay in the Republican Party, for example, or the Democrat Party, I guess, but especially most of these days it's the Republican Party we have to contend with in this kind of thing, and beat their heads against the establishment where they could be helping to build a vibrant new party. And I think part of the problem is, if I may take one more step on this, is that people aren't used to doing anything anymore. When I was young, 10 to 12 years old, when I got involved in politics, or 8 or whatever it was, people went to meetings maybe once a month for some kind of civic activity, or once a week maybe. Now, most people think that liking something on Facebook or commenting is political action. And it's just not. People have, if they want to save the nation, they're going to have to get involved a little bit. They're going to have to learn to do things again and take some risks of having their neighbor or someone, not like them, maybe, but or not like what they have to say. But people are going to have to get involved again.
And Jim, you said that George Washington made some remarks about how political parties are not good for our country. I'd like to hear a few more comments on that, because how did our founding fathers function without political parties? Or was there a time when we didn't have political parties?
It was George Washington in his farewell address that he warned of the danger of political parties and what can happen. And that's what I was referring to, that I certainly agree with him on that. Now, he was elected without being a member of a party. He was not a party, but I think the parties were already forming during his administration, and that's where he foresaw the dangers that could come from political parties. So I think... And Gary maybe knows the history better than I do on this, but I think that he was the only one who was ever elected without a political party, that from then on everyone who was elected did ascribe to some political party. So it very quickly developed, but George Washington certainly saw the dangers of it.
I think we're fed up with a lot of these squabbles, and it's not serving us well. I had my own, a lot of people will say, if you don't like the system or if you don't like the candidate, address it in the primary. Don't wait till the general. Just get the bad guys out in the primary. It's a lot easier. Well, that's a joke, because I actually tried it. There was a bad Republican senator who voted more left-wing than many of the Democrats. He liked big government. He liked intrusive government. He was pro-gambling. He was pretty much one of those people that deserved a primary. I gave him a primary. And during the process, it turned out to be very educational. And it was worth it just for the sake of the experiment. Because what I found out is a lot of Republicans came up to me and questioned me, why would I run against him? And showed a great deal of disdain for the fact that I would dare to primary my opponent. So here's what ends up in all practicality. Even though his term was 4 years and the term was up, because in Missouri you can actually serve two terms in the Senate, in people's minds, his term wasn't up yet. He was entitled to another term. And in many states without term limits, your term is effectively until you die. You get to think of Ted Kennedy and think of the Supreme Court justices who feel like they're entitled to stay there forever. So the question has emerged, maybe we should have closed primaries in our state. Right now, anybody can claim to vote on with any party they want. Do either of you have an opinion on the benefit of having closed primaries where you have to affiliate with a party before you can vote in that primary election?
Well, we have closed primaries in Pennsylvania. And I guess I throw out, and then because we have, Pennsylvania is a very strong party state. The party controls so much. Of course, they want a closed primary for their control. I would say that if the taxpayers have to pay for their primaries, then they ought to at least be open. And everybody should be able to vote in a primary, whether it be Republicans, Democrats, Independents, or whatever. And if they don't like that, then I say then pay for their own primaries. But if I can't vote in a primary in Pennsylvania, I'm precluded from voting in a primary, and because I don't fit into any of those either of the major parties.
Now I would point out that in California, and one reason that I was for a primary system is that every party that qualified for the ballot had a primary, whether the Green or the, at the time, American Independent Party, which was my party most of my life, or the Libertarian Party or whatever. We had primaries, so we weren't excluded as you have in Pennsylvania, where you only have the major parties are allowed to have primaries. So that's one reason why I have a little different view on that, is because we were allowed to have primaries and based our entire organizational structure on the results of the primary. So, and we had it both ways. We started off closed, and we supported opening them up simply to get more people to vote and, you know, have for our candidates in the primary, and it did a bit. I don't think it made a big difference. But they don't like open primaries. You see it in presidential elections where you've got crossover voting in the primary, you got maybe an incumbent or no contest in one party, so all the people who are not really interested in voting in that primary because there's no contest will go over and vote for whoever they consider is the weakest candidate in the other party, and the party that's a victim of that, or at least they feel like they're a victim, gets all upset that their delegates are being picked by the other party. And so, you can see why they want to nip that in the bud. And, I really don't care. The more problems they have, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
There are a lot of people who believe the reason Todd Akin won our Senate primary is because a lot of Democrats picked the one that would be easiest to pick off. And then Claire McCaskill ran ads on TV saying, Todd Akin is just too conservative for our state. And because of all that, they believe that the Democrats set him up for a great defeat. I think the reason he lost is because the Republicans didn't support him. I don't think it had to do with the open primary process. But you're saying both of you agree that open primaries, if they're going to pay for primaries, are fine?
I don't have a problem with it. But more than that, I think we should have more choices in the political system. Americans are kind of inculcated to believe that maybe through the educational system and just TV and everything else, that you only have two choices. But that's insanity. When you go to the market, you're not limited to two choices. There's plenty of choices. If you go to 31 flavors, do they have just two choices? No, they have, I guess, 31 or more flavors. Why should we be limited to two choices on the ballot, the Republicans or the Democrats? If they're both doing a terrible job, maybe we should have another choice. But that's going to take, you know, they're not going to open up the system. They have, they meaning the Democrats and Republicans and the powers that be, are not going to open up the system for us necessarily. With some pressure, they might loosen some rules. It takes people to get involved and to do something, but it's just insanity. It's pendulum politics, and they love it that way. They go, you know, we elect somebody, and after a while things get terrible, and they swing the pendulum the other way, and people think this person's going to answer it, and after time, you know, to the Democrats, Republicans, whatever, and then they and things, you know, continue to get worse. And what's the answer? Well, let's just go back the other way. And the people at the top, the special interests at the fulcrum, they couldn't care less whether you swing the pendulum to the Democrat side or the Republican side. It's all the same to them. Bigger government, more control, you know, the more ties, you know, more ties between government and corporations and business, and the people are marginalized more and more. So we got to get rid of the paradigm of pendulum politics and get to a paradigm where people, where choices are considered as important in politics as they are at the market.
Well, Jim, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. We don't want to leave people in despair. We do not want my listeners to think the situation is hopeless. So what are the things we can do to turn this around? I mean, you're a lawyer, and you're from the land of slower horses and older women. Explain to us, how are we going to make a difference? We've got 2014 right around the corner. We've got 2016 right after that. How are we going to break the grip of the powers that be so that freedom can actually be seen at the ballot box?
Well, listen, I sort of have a two-pronged message on that topic. On the one hand, I've been fighting for ballot access and equality in ballot access for years, and I plan to continue to do that. I think we need to do that on all fronts, both on the in the courts as well as in the legislatures, and hold their feet to the fire and make a continue a concerted effort to equal access to the ballot box. On the other hand, I've got a message for our own people, and that is, politics is hard work. You didn't get to become a state legislator without working hard at it. And some of our people sort of hide behind the excuse of, well, it's difficult to get on the ballot, it's difficult to get signatures and this and that, and it takes a lot of money, and we don't have money, and so on. Use that as an excuse where they think it should be handed to them. And I'm going to say to our own Constitution Party or independent people that that's not the way the game is played. It's hard work, and you should expect the battle. You should expect to put out. You should expect to sacrifice a lot if you want to play this game. And you should be willing to put up the money, to put in the effort, to go out there and pound the pavement, beat on doors, and do whatever's necessary in the political process. Too many of our people, I say this kindly but yet critically, too many of our people think that they ought to be able to start out at the top, but they should just, you know, be able to run for president or U.S. Senate without any effort, and they should be able to participate in everything with on an equal level with people who have been working at it within their respective parties for years to get to that position. And again, doesn't work that way. It takes a lot of effort, a lot of work, and many times a lot of money to get to the place at the table. And we should expect that, whether we're a third party, minor party, independent, or whatever it may be. And so I have that dual message. Let's fight for equality and access to the ballot box, but let's also not expect everything to be handed to us. Let's be willing to get out there and work for it.
That's good. How about you, Gary? Can you add to that?
Basically, I add an amen and just say that a lot of times now in this day and age, of so many areas, the table seems to be already set. There's not a lot of areas to pioneer. But they're not going to set the table for us. We have to set our own table. And we have to be prepared to do our, politics is really like a small town with two plumbers, and they're both crooked and they're both incompetent. And if you switch between the two, and the leaky faucet turns into a flooded basement, and maybe there comes a time when you figure out, well, maybe I ought to learn to do plumbing myself in order to save the foundation of my home. And it takes some work. As Jim said, you have to learn some things. You have to get involved. If we could just pay somebody else to do things, and I'm not a mechanic. I always have people work on my car, but fortunately I have lots of choices. But we have just, again, in politics, we seemingly have two choices that we're told mean anything. Well, if those two choices are much like those two crooked plumbers who are greedy, corrupt, and incompetent, we need maybe to start solving these problems ourselves and take the initiative ourselves. So I have the same message as Jim. It's not going to be easy, but this country is worth saving.
That's good. That's a good word. And I'd also like to remind you that Ben Swan is going to be speaking at our conference in Cincinnati in November. And I saw a video he put together talking about this very same topic. His last name is spelled with two N's. It's Ben Swan. And he had on his video a picture of the scene in St. Charles County, where I live, of people getting arrested, which to me is a hilarious example of how parties can go awry. So guys, thank you for joining us. I know that in terms of billable hours, you gave us a great contribution. Will you be on the show again sometime?
I'd certainly be happy
to. Pleased to.
Good, it's a commitment. Okay, thank you much. We need to be enlightened. This was exactly what needed to be said, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, Cynthia, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for the opportunity to be on.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.
It's the